This is now our fourth message in the book of Ruth. If you haven't listened to the previous messages in the series, you'll want to listen to those before you listen to this one. Previously, we left only four verses unstudied, so we're going to look into those, but we're also going to go back through the book, tidying up some loose ends. The four verses, chapter 4, verses 18 through 22, give a genealogy relating Ruth to David, so we'll consider that. We'll also contemplate the historicity of the book, and we'll consider a couple of other themes and lessons that can be drawn from the book, things like the value of thankfulness, or the importance of having a good reputation, or the value of working hard and acquiring wealth, but not loving it. So then, you could read over the entire book of Ruth, since we'll be jumping around in it, but the four verses we have not yet contemplated are short, and so I will read them to you from the ESV. They are Ruth chapter 4, verses 18 through 22. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron, Hezron fathered Ram, Ram fathered Amminadab, Amminadab fathered Nahshon, Nahshon fathered Salmon, Salmon fathered Boaz, Boaz fathered Obed, Obed fathered Jesse, and Jesse fathered David. So we have here a genealogy, and we generally like to compare genealogies in the Bible with others to see if they give us any other interesting information about the characters. And in this case, we will see that the Bible is consistent in describing David's line. The genealogy starts with Perez. If you aren't particularly into studying biblical genealogies, that name might not ring a bell, but anyone living in the tribe of Judah at the time would have known his name. Judah was the ancestral father of the tribe, and Perez was his son. So starting with Perez basically takes us back to the beginning of the tribe. Perez was Judah's son by Tamar, as we see recorded in Genesis 38. 1 Chronicles 2:4 confirms this, agreeing with Genesis. Perez would have been in the generation that went down to Egypt in the end of the book of Genesis. If we continue looking at the account in Chronicles chapter 2, we see perfect agreement with the genealogy in Ruth, but it provides more detail in that it also lists the brothers of each generation. Hezron is mentioned in verse 5, Ram in verse 9, Amminadab and Nahshon in verse 10, Salmon and Boaz in verse 11, Jesse in verse 12, and David, along with all of his brothers, are listed in verses 13 through 15. As a quick aside in studying these genealogies, I noticed that 1 Chronicles 4 mentions Ephrathah as having been a father of the people of Bethlehem. In a previous message, I had speculated that Ephrathah might have been a Canaanite name for Bethlehem prior to Israel's occupation of the land, but based on 1 Chronicles 4:4, I have to amend that. The city simply had an alternate name, calling it after this ancestral father. The genealogy of David in Matthew 1, 1-6 is also in perfect agreement with this genealogy. One question that might come up in studying that genealogy in Matthew is that it mentions Boaz as being the son of Rahab, and that could cause some confusion, because we would expect that Rahab, a character mentioned in the opening chapters of Joshua, would have been a few generations older than Boaz, and thus likely too old to be his mother. This would be possible if the genealogy leaves out a few generations, and this is very well possible. As I have noted many times before, Hebrew doesn't draw a distinction between a mother and a grandmother, or even a great-grandmother. There are other solutions to this question as well, however, we won't be considering them today because we already considered them previously. For more on that, you could listen to our message, Rahab and the Spies, which was published February 23rd of 2020. Also, while we are considering genealogies, we should note the implications of Ruth, and perhaps also Rahab, on David's lineage. It is possible that one of the reasons this story is included in the Bible is to explain David's ancestral relationship to Moab. Now, we haven't really talked about King David yet, but he is going to be coming up in the next book. That's 1 Samuel. We note that David, at least in the stages of his life before he became king, maintained a cozy relationship with Moab, one which helped him survive during the reign of Saul. 1 Samuel 22 records how, for instance, when David was on the run from Saul, he left his parents in the care of the king of Moab, evidently to ensure that Saul would not harm them. I suspect that having some Moabite blood might have helped to facilitate this. However, that cozy relationship and international background could have raised questions about the legitimacy of David as king. Particularly, Deuteronomy 23 might be mistaken to say that a person of mixed nationality could not enter the congregation of Jehovah. Of course, we know that isn't a problem in David's case because the proper rendering of that text would be that no bastard could enter the congregation, as the King James correctly translates the term. For deeper consideration on that topic, you could listen to our message roundup, Miscellaneous in Moses, Part 1, published November 10th of 2019. We should also consider that the Bible prohibits, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, a king of foreign birth from reigning on the throne. However, this would not be applicable in David's case because David was a son of Boaz, and Boaz was certainly of Israelite descent. This would not have been figured through the mother. Also of note, David's relationship with Moab did not stay cozy throughout his reign. 2 Samuel 8:12 records how David ultimately defeated the Moabites in battle, killing two-thirds of their warriors and essentially enslaving the rest. Having considered the genealogy, I want to discuss briefly the historicity of the Book of Ruth. This book was clearly not written at the time it occurred. As we mentioned last week, Ruth 4:7 refers to the events of the book as having occurred in former times. This is a contrast to some other books we have studied. Exodus through Deuteronomy, for example, describe the life of Moses and make pretty clear claims that he was also the author of those books. The book of Joshua also claims that Joshua wrote the things down, so those were definitely first-hand accounts of some pretty incredible events and not far removed in time from those events. However, Ruth is seemingly farther removed. My supposition is that the book was written in the time of King David. The genealogy, presuming it was part of the original autograph, suggests that the book was written generations after Ruth, but since it stops at David, it probably wasn't written at a time after that. We would think that if some other king descended from David and he was on the throne at that time, then he would have also been included on the list. Now, the book being written in the time of David does not rule out it being a first-hand account. Ruth was David's great-grandmother, and it does not stretch credulity to suppose that she might have still been alive in David's lifetime to compose the book or to have some input in its composition. In all likelihood, David, for whatever reason, had this book written and added to the royal history, which gave it enough importance to be carried on with the rest of Israel's historical, legal, and genealogical documents, which ultimately formed a large part of the Hebrew portion of the scriptures. The creation of the book of Ruth, then, is not significantly different from the book of Samuel, which follows it. It was written in the time of David by an unknown author as part of the kingdom's historical record. But the three-generation lapse in time between the events of Ruth and the creation of the book of Ruth could cause some to question whether the book is a genuine historical account. Over time, aspects of a story tend to become embellished, or even wholly invented. So I think that it is good for us to take note of some of the historical markers that help to evidence that this is a work of history and not of fiction. Now, I would note in doing this that we don't ever expect external sources to prove the truth of the Bible. There is no evidence that can prove with absolute certainty precisely what happened in any historical event. Even modern video and audio recordings can't show us everything and can be subject to manipulation or misinterpretation. And besides, we don't believe the Bible because of what archaeology would tell us about it. We believe the Bible because Jesus believed the Bible. Jesus claimed, and his followers claimed for him, that he was the perfect Son of God, and he fulfilled prophecies and performed incredible miracles, most notably rising from the dead, to demonstrate this. We believe in Jesus, and because we believe in Jesus, we believe the Bible that he believed. We also accept the Bible on its own terms. The Bible claims to be an accurate record of historical events, and as a general rule, scholars accept historical records unless there is some compelling reason not to do so. We would display a certain generational arrogance to presume that we know better what happened to a people from the distant past than they knew what happened to them. In this case, telling King David that his story about his grandmother isn't true would be about as silly as someone who doesn't know you or anything about your family telling you that you don't know a story told by your grandmother. Unless there's some compelling reason not to believe David's record here, we should take his word for it. So with all of that in mind, let's consider how a knowledge of history suggests the truth of this book. First, let's note how hard it is to write a good historical fiction. Today we have the internet, with vast amounts of information readily available at our fingertips. We have accurate maps drawn from satellites in space. We have a population with a near 100% literacy rate. We have libraries in almost any town. Information is widely available to us in a way that it was not available in any other generation ever. And yet, if I was to try and write you a historical fiction about something that happened in, say, World War I, about as long ago, it would be an uphill battle for me. I might look at a map of my area, decide to set the story in a neighboring town, only to find out later that that town wasn't founded until after the war. I might name the wrong person as having held some obscure public office. I might mention anachronistic technologies or put characters into situations that would not make sense because the culture and manners have changed. But Ruth seems to get all such things right. If Ruth had been written at some much later date, say hundreds of years later, even if the author was reasonably familiar with the place and its customs, since he would be lacking in the kind of records that are available to us today, he would have probably gotten something wrong. But everywhere we look, we see elements of this story that make sense in the historical context. So, for example, the Book of Ruth accurately describes ancient agricultural practices like reaping, threshing, and winnowing. The author also understood the cultural practices of allowing the poor to glean the fields, which our comparison to the Torah confirmed, and which was central to the story. The story claims to have taken place in the time of the judges, and a famine, which was an important element of the story, makes a lot of sense when compared to the social instability of that time period. We speculated that this story had occurred during the rule of Samson, and if that is correct, then that would also make very good sense. Samson's rule from Dan, which bordered Judah, was a rebellion against an imperial Philistia, and it could have caused significant economic turmoil in Judah, which would have sent people from Judah traveling east toward Moab. Samson's tactic of burning Philistine crops in particular could have had an impact on the food supply of the entire region. Seeing that a famine was central to this story, that makes a lot of sense. The story also accurately represents the map. It mentions Bethlehem, which is correctly placed in Judah. It knows that Ephrathah is an alternate name for the city. It knew it better than I knew it. A key element of the story is that a family migrated from Bethlehem to Moab. Moab was a close neighbor of Judah. This all makes sense. The story presents an accurate understanding of law and custom. Levirate marriage is a central theme in the story, and the story describes it accurately, right up to the point that the man who should have redeemed Ruth was made to observe custom by removing his sandal. This is something that the passage seems to indicate was not really a commonly known fact at the time this book was written. The story correctly describes how legal matters were resolved by meetings of the elders at the city gates. The story presents immigration customs, which were in keeping with what the law at the time would have allowed. In chapter 2, Ruth presumed that Boaz would have had a dislike for her since she was a Moabite. This is also not unreasonable because there had been war and bad blood between the Moabites and Israelites in the generations preceding this one. And of course, we can't overlook that the book accurately placed its events in the time of the judges. If the book had said Ruth lived in the time of the kings or during Joshua's conquest, we would have had reason not to believe it, but it is set at the right time for Ruth to be David's great-grandmother. In describing David's genealogy, this book matches the records that we have everywhere else. In short, when we look at this book thinking that we might find some error which would suggest that the book is a forgery or from a much later time or a far removed place, we find nothing to suggest that. Much to the contrary, we find the book harmonizes very well with what we know about history from other sources. There is nothing in the book whatsoever to suggest that it is anything but a true account which is authentically historical. We note also that the book is fairly mundane. It doesn't make any claims that are particularly difficult to believe, even for a skeptic, so it generally doesn't draw much criticism anyway. You know, if Ruth had been accurate in every other regard but had made a claim that there were space aliens involved or something, then we might be demanding a first-hand account. But this is a fairly straightforward story of a landowner taking a widow in marriage. It's nothing we can't easily accept. And so finding no reason to disbelieve the Book of Ruth and every reason to accept it, we do. Let us move on from there to discussing some applicable lessons from Ruth that we passed over previously. First, we should note the importance of reputation in this book. We see twice in the book that Ruth's reputation got her ahead in life. When Ruth was first introduced to Boaz in chapter 2, Boaz's servants gave a good account of her work, and when Boaz spoke to Ruth, he told her explicitly that he favored her because a good report about her faithfulness to Naomi had been given to him. Later on, when Ruth sought Boaz's redemption in chapter 3, Boaz said in verse 11 that he would redeem her because, quote, "all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman," end quote. And so we can see that being of good repute got Ruth ahead. Had she been a woman of poor reputation, she might not have been so welcome in Boaz's field and might not have been ultimately redeemed by him. Proverbs 22:1 tells us, "A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold." Indeed, in this case, having a good name got Ruth a good harvest and then a good husband who had great wealth. A good name took her far. farther than a few gold coins would have. In contrast, it can be very difficult to overcome having a bad reputation. Reputation matters. There are two elements to having a good reputation. The first is what you do, and the second is what people say about what you do. Ruth was faithful to Naomi and a hard worker. She consistently displayed good character over time, and seeing this, people began to think well of her. But what she did was only half of the equation. The other half is that people spoke honestly about the good things that she did, and thus it was known even to those who had not experienced her good deeds directly that she was a worthy person. And so from this, we draw two valuable lessons, lessons worth more than silver and gold. If we want a good reputation, we should strive to do good works, and we should remember that to gain a good reputation and keep it, we must do good works consistently. One seriously wrong action or one season of misbehavior can overshadow years of good work. And also, we must all be careful about what we say about others. Proverbs 16:28 tells us that a dishonest man spreads strife and a whisperer separates close friends. It is a serious sin to bear false witness against your neighbor, so much so that the Ten Commandments command against this. We should not spread a defamatory report about a person if it is not true, especially. This would harm that person's reputation unfairly, and that would bring about serious harm to that person. Words come very easily, but cleaning up the damage that they cause is very difficult. Much the opposite of spreading a damaging false report, we should be looking for opportunities to build up the reputations of our Christian brothers. When we see good works in others, we should not be shy about telling others so that those who do good can reap the benefits of a good reputation rightly earned. We also should not be shy in displaying our thankfulness to those who do good for us as individuals and for the church as a whole. We don't just need to spread a good report to others about those who do good. We should give feedback to the people who do good as well. We see a good example of thankfulness and where it can get a person in the story of Ruth at chapter 2. There, Boaz had been generous to Ruth by allowing her to glean in his fields and had gone a step above by letting her drink the worker's water without having to draw her own. Ruth responded to Boaz respectfully and with thanks, and the result of this was that Boaz gave her more. After Ruth had given her thanks, Boaz invited her right up to the table and had his workers give her extra perks. Ruth's thankfulness helped to strengthen her relationship with Boaz, and that relationship brought Ruth far. And in the end, when all the conflicts were resolved, everyone showed thankfulness to God. Ruth landed a husband, she had a child to carry on Elimelech's line, and everyone's needs were provided for. The example given to us by the women of the town was to bless God's name for these good circumstances. We also should not neglect to show thankfulness to God when we receive good things in life. We should remember that God doesn't owe us any good thing, but that He gives us good things as a grace. And finally, we should contemplate our relationship to the good things that God has given us. Boaz was a man of wealth, and he worked for that wealth. He wasn't just a man who inherited wealth and then lived off of the interest while other people did the work. He was in the fields and on the threshing floor with the men he employed. But while Boaz had worked for his wealth, he didn't love his wealth, or at least, he didn't love his wealth more than he loved his God and his neighbor. We see this in that he was generous to the poor, and in that he was quick to fulfill his duty as a redeemer to Ruth. He could have been like an anonymous redeemer who rejected the duty. He could have loved the wealth of his estate more than the widow and more than his God. But then, he would have loved his money too much. 1 Timothy 6:10 tells us that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. But in that case, why should a righteous man like Boaz work for money at all? And why amass it to become a wealthy man in the first place? We should note that it is not wrong to have wealth. If wealth is earned through valuable labors and if it is kept through thrift, then we could judge the wealth as a good measure of a person's value to society. As a man serves others, he gains more, and as he puts less burden on others, he saves more. A wealthy man is a man who serves more than he consumes, a man who gives more than he takes, a man who works more than he plays. And there is certainly no wrong in that. Indeed, the act of loving and serving others can lead to the generation of great wealth. The error of wealth comes when a person amasses it through injustice. When a person becomes rich by taking advantage of others, by breaking the laws of God, or by working with financial mechanisms that are socially detrimental. You don't love money when you earn it and save it. You love money when you put it ahead of your love for God and for your neighbor. And this is manifest in how you earn your money and what you do with it once you have it. Money can be a useful tool in accomplishing gospel ministry, in serving the poor, in bringing about beneficial social change, and as an investment in worthwhile ventures which will serve the best interest of everyone. To use money for such purposes is good and does not constitute a love of money. And this is what we see in the book of Ruth. Boaz used his wealth to employ workers in a valuable business, to help the poor, and ultimately to acquire a wife. This was good for him and for everyone involved. Certainly it is better to be Boaz, a man who can afford a good wife, than the anonymous redeemer who could not. My exhortation to you, then, is that you engage in beneficial activities, serving others and generating wealth, and that you use your wealth not only for your own pleasures, but in such a way that you are a greater benefit to yourself and those around you. To conclude, then, this is the last message on the Book of Ruth, and as such, we've used it to wrap up the remaining text and to tie up some loose ends. We've given due consideration to the genealogy of David, finding it to be consistent throughout the scriptures. This gave us cause to pay attention to the historicity of the book, and in that attentiveness we found nothing here lacking. And finally, we contemplated some themes in Ruth and some of the moral applications for our own lives, namely, that we should live with thankfulness, that we should live in such a way as to earn a good reputation, and should protect the reputations of others as we would like ours protected, and that we should be wise with our wealth. From here, we will be taking a break between books to study a few Psalms and maybe a few other topics, and then we'll be ready to move into a study of 1 Samuel in which we'll finally dig into a deeper study of the oft-mentioned King David. I do hope you'll join us then. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.